This is Judge Sleater presiding, Judges Werke and Cochran joining me, and this is the third of three scheduled oral arguments today. A21632, State of Minnesota versus Victor Gustavo Ventura Mendez. And this is September 16, and welcome to both of you and to those who are participating and listening in. The process is the same as you're familiar with, of course, by now with the Zoom process. You can see the clock in the corner. The marshal will pause the clock if for some reason we lose you in any method so that we until we're reconnected. And just a reminder to all those who are listening as well that there's no recording allowed. There will be a recording available on the state court's website within 24 hours of this proceeding. And so with that in mind, appellant's counsel, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the appellant Victorino Ventura Mendez. May it please the court and counsel. Your Honors, this morning, this case concerns Mr. Ventura's Rule 412 motion to admit evidence of sexual abuse by his co-defendant, Cesar Lopez Ramos, in order to show an alternative source for the young victim's sexual knowledge.
Ms. Werke, before you get into the merits, yes. I apologize because I didn't see a reply brief, but Respondent's Counsel pointed out the improper conviction, multiple convictions of both first degree offenses. I somewhat assume your client agrees with that and that we should have remand to clarify the record.
Yes, Your Honor. I do agree with that. And I don't take issue with it. And thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you.
Your Honor, as I was not the party to request argument here today, I just have about 3 points that I want to make. And of course, I'm happy to take the court's questions. The first point I would like to make concerns the alternative perpetrator defense. Respondent argues that Mr. Ventura never sought admission of the Lopez Ramos evidence as alternative perpetrator evidence, and that is incorrect. Index 46, which is Mr. Ventura's Rule 412 motion, cited his alternative perpetrator defense as a reason for why the district court should admit evidence of the victim's abuse by Mr. Lopez Ramos. The Rule 412 evidence and the alternative perpetrator defense in this case go hand in hand. They are interlinked. By asking for admission of the evidence of Lopez Ramos's sexual abuse of the victim, Mr. Ventura was essentially establishing his alternative perpetrator defense. There was no separate motion to seek to introduce the what I call AP evidence because there did not need to be one here. Once the 412 motion was denied, that was an effectual denial of the alternative perpetrator motion as well. Any suggestion that Mr. Ventura somehow forfeited that is just incorrect because that's a misunderstanding of how these two go together.
Ms. Workman,
go ahead.
I wanted to explore that just a little bit. I'm having a little bit of a hard time understanding. It strikes me that the alternate source of knowledge may include an alternative perpetrator, but doesn't necessarily, because we're really focused on the source of knowledge from certainly earlier incidents. And wouldn't there first have to be, and the judge seemed to point this out there. So primarily, is it not true that the alternate source is a fabrication, first and foremost, allegation? And it's the explanation for a purported fabrication, which might lead to an alternate perpetrator, but you still have to kind of get past that first stage. And it seems the judge made the point that there was no threshold evidence or finding, number one, that the victim or the state's evidence, or the victim in particular, fabricated. But moreover, the basis of the state's case seemed contrary to alternate source, but simply because you have the DNA evidence, you have the admission from your client. And so it just never got to that point. Am I misunderstanding the record?
I see your point. However, there is not a requirement for fabrication to be brought up before an alternative perpetrator has to be is allowed to be introduced. Alternative perpetrator isn't just for criminal sexual conduct cases. Of course, it goes for
maybe I didn't ask my question. I mean, that was kind of the point of my question. It seemed you these are two different topics, which may be interrelated, but it seemed to me it's primarily the first. And I noticed in your brief, you pointed this out, the alternate source of knowledge is the basis upon which, not alternate perpetrator. It just happened to be that might be the result.
Right.
Am I misstating the law?
You know, that's why these two are so interlinked. And it's hard to divorce these two because of the facts of this case. So I think it was the understanding of the parties, and it's probably not very clear from the record, but this is the understanding of the parties, is that the alternative source that was being pointed to in this case was actually the alternative perpetrator, which would be Mr. Lopez Ramos. And that is actually more clarified in Mr. Ventura's 412 motion when you read through that. The point here is that by saying that there is an alternative source of her sexual knowledge, that gets into the fact that it was Mr. Lopez Ramos, the alternative perpetrator in this case. Now, not in every Rule 412 case are you going to have an alternative perpetrator type of situation, but that is the case here, that the two go together. And so you kind of have to understand them together just based on the facts of this case. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
It did aid me. I appreciate that.
Ms. Workman.
Yes, go ahead.
Turning to the motion itself, which I'm looking at before me, the focus of the motion was seeking to admit the evidence as an independent source of sexual knowledge. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So there's only one brief reference to alternative perpetrator evidence, which is, you know, I mean, extremely brief. In reading it, I wouldn't read this motion understand it to be made for that purpose. But in any event, the focus, I think we can all agree, is on the independent source of sexual knowledge, that's the purpose of the motion. So given that, and given that the individual was 12 years old when the alleged conduct occurred, what basis in there is there in the record to suggest that at age 12, she was unfamiliar with the type of sexual conduct at issue here, which was pretty straightforward sexual conduct as far as that goes?
Well, I think you have pointed to an issue that I did want to speak to, Judge Cochran. So thank you for getting us there. It's the age of the victim makes this even more relevant. And the reason it's relevant is because of her extremely young age. I think we can all agree that a 12-year-old should not have sexual knowledge and detailed sexual knowledge as she did in this case. So it makes it much more likely, much more relevant to this case, that abuse, a criminal act, is what gave her this sexual knowledge. Now, the respondent has suggested that you should look at her age at the time that she testified, which is 16, and that's not correct. You have to look at the time that she made her complaint, which is around 11 or 12 years old. It's a little unclear. I believe she was 12 years old when she finally made the complaint against Mr. Ventura, maybe 11 to just had turned 12 when she made the complaint against Mr. Lopez Ramos. The fact here is that she'd had 4 years in between the time that she testified and the time that she made the complaint to sort of up her sexual knowledge, so to speak. So what we're looking at here is whether a 12-year-old at the time that she makes her complaint would be able to know these things. And that's the purpose here. I'm sorry that I have a phone that's ringing in the background. My staff was supposed to not call me. So let me just hang that up really quick. I'm very sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Workman.
You're welcome. My
just
apologies.
Following up on that point then regarding the knowledge of a 12-year-old, was there any information submitted along with the motion, an affidavit or anything in support of the motion to indicate that a 12-year-old wouldn't have this type of knowledge? I mean, you know, it unfortunately in today's world, 12-year-olds are exposed to a lot. So
I don't think there was extensive, goodness. I don't think that there was extensive understanding of or extensive facts that were brought out in the record. I think everyone was working on an understanding that 12-year-olds absolutely should not have this type of sexual knowledge. It's not appropriate. And there was nothing in the record that says that she did have the sexual knowledge before. So that's something to consider as well. And that kind of brings
Ms. Workman, just to follow up with that, then what is the evidence in the record that it required a sexual knowledge to accuse the appellant of doing what the appellant did? If you follow my question.
Yes. I think we have to also look at the Lopez Ramos complaint as well, because she, something that we don't need to forget here is that there were overlapping time periods of alleged abuse. And so the complaint that she made first was against Lopez Ramos, and then the allegations came out against Mr. Ventura later. So regarding the relevance of all of this, how it comes in, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm kind of blanking out on your question. You were asking about the...
You were talking in an answer to Judge Cochran's question that that her source of knowledge, what I'm trying to get a handle on from the record, especially, and the judge kind of did this, and it seems like it ties into the probative balance of prejudice when you have a confession and DNA evidence and just her statements, which are consistent, as I understand, her forensic statement with her oral statement. It strikes me as it as not a, maybe this goes back why I keep coming back to fabrication, because it strikes me that, again, first and foremost, before you can get to an alternate perpetrator, you're attempting to show to the jury that this victim is fabricating an allegation against my client. And in order to show that, you want to demonstrate somehow she acquired this knowledge from someone else.
I see what you're getting
and
at.
And here we've got the judge really focused on that, the fact that you've got other objective evidence in addition to the victim, and then did the weighing with regard to that. Can you comment to that? Did that
yes. Help? So I think this all goes into the pot of relevance and prejudice. And when you have to look at it as a whole, as a totality of the circumstances, and not just sort of like a tunnel vision here. And I think that's a little bit of what that happened to the district court. The district court's order has this flair of, you know, there's evidence of guilt against the defendant, so I'm not going to allow the defendant to put forward a defense, but not without knowing what the Lopez Ramos evidence was in full. So if the Lopez Ramos evidence had been introduced at trial, then Mr. Ventura would have been able to handle these DNA results more rigorously. There was rigorous cross-examination as to the methodology used by the analyst, as to the results, as to related individuals. When you have DNA testing involving related individuals, it's more complicated. So his counsel could have gotten into much more of a discussion and testing on cross-examination of this evidence and the efficacy of these results. So that's number one, that it could have gone to that. It also lends the Lopez Ramos evidence lends credibility to appellant's claim that his confession was coerced. And so with all of this together, it changes when you introduce this evidence, it changes the entire landscape of this trial. Now, when you go back to how does this affect fabrication, I don't believe that there is an actual requirement in the statute or the case law that you have to show fabrication before you get to bring in a 412 evidence, and in this case, a type of alternative perpetrator evidence. But regarding that, the allegation that someone else was involved at the very same time doing this very same acts is enough and makes it relevant to see that there's a problem here. You know, maybe she didn't understand what was going on and fabricated some of these allegations against one person or another. So in this sense, you have to look at the totality of the evidence, the weight of it upon how the evidence would be viewed by the jury. And remember that this is a factual issue for the jury, and taking a factual issue away that affects Mr. Ventura's ability to put forward a meaningful defense is very critical in this type of case. Are there any other questions from the panel?
There appears not to be. Did you want to make a final statement before we turn to respondents' counsel?
Your Honors, I will just defer to my rebuttal period. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And counsel, for responding, may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. I believe the state's primary arguments are set out adequately in my brief, so I want to focus in on points that have come up during appellant's time at oral argument here today. And in particular, I want to focus on the question of the alternative perpetrator defense. And I think the questions from the court suggest that the court's well aware of a very important thing, that these are two separate analyses. And I don't think that the defendant's offhand remark in his Rule 412 motion is sufficient to raise an alternative perpetrator defense. The court may be aware that Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 9.02 Subdivision 1, Parens 5, requires the defendant to give written notice of his intention to raise any defense other than not guilty, including an alternative perpetrator defense, prior to the omnibus hearing. The omnibus hearing in this case was held in November of 2019, over 3 months before the Rule 412 motion was held. The defendant gave no notice of an intention to assert an alternative perpetrator defense prior to the omnibus hearing. I think it's certainly arguable by failing to do so, he completely waived his ability to make that defense. And specifically, he should have had to give a separate notice, and there could have been separate hearings about the alternative perpetrator defense, because that has different elements that need to be considered. And before the court determines whether that can be presented to the jury. I've discussed some of the analysis in I think it's footnote 8 of my brief, and I won't rehearse that here. But I think the most salient point is that there has to be some other evidence beyond the alternative perpetrator evidence that the defendant seeks to offer that has an inherent tendency to connect the proposed alternative perpetrator with the actual commission of the crime. And I think that's important here, the crime. The crime here is the sexual act that led to the conception of the victim's baby. And there's a lot of talk about how there was similar conduct going on at similar times, but ultimately what we have here is a particular act of sexual intercourse that led to the conception of a child. And that's
Mr. Smith. Do you agree with Ms. Workman's statement that some threshold showing a fabrication is not necessary in order for the court to consider the 412 evidence?
That's the way I read the law, is that there are different sort of exceptions that are recognized. Fabrication would be one. Other source of sexual knowledge is another, and I think a separate one. And that's the one, other source of sexual knowledge, not fabrication. The appellant has never raised a claim of fabrication. And I think that's important to note. Even though the district court said there's just no evidence of fabrication, and the Lopez-Ramos evidence wouldn't be admissible to show fabrication because the prior accusation against Lopez-Ramos wasn't fabricated. Not only was there no probability that it was fabricated, but that defendant was convicted by a jury. The state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that what the victim said Lopez Ramos had done, he had in fact done.
Could you clarify for me then? You kind of separated into three different pots, if I understand. One, fabrication. One, you separated the alternate source, the knowledge, from the third one being alternative perpetrator. My question is, under the alternate source, what does it mean if ultimately a court believes there's sufficient evidence of an alternate source, therefore the jury should hear that as it relates to the victim's testimony?
So
you follow my question.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little bit hard to exactly suss out what the decisions anticipate the purpose for which that evidence is actually going to be used. But I think it's to diffuse the temptation that juries might have to say that this low-functioning adult who has a mental acuity of a 7.5-year-old has no capacity for abstraction or fabrication wouldn't know these things unless what the victim says happened and that the defendant did is true. I think that's the limited purpose for which other source knowledge is used, is to diffuse that sort of inference that it seems like juries might be tempted to make. And the argument, I suppose, that maybe prosecutors might be inclined to make is that the defendant is credible about this. The victim is credible about what happened because there's no way the victim could have known these things if they didn't actually happen. But that simply isn't the case we have here. And the district court found that this kind of evidence wasn't relevant here based on the fact that the circumstances here taken as a whole aren't such that the jury was likely to infer that the only possible source for the victim's sexual knowledge was what the defendant was alleged to have done to her. And I think I take umbrage with the characterization of a 12-year-old as a very young victim. This is not a 3-year-old. This is not a 4-year-old. This court has affirmed, albeit in an unpublished decision, a district court's conclusion that other source knowledge was not admissible when the victims were 7 and 9 at the time of the offense, and I think 11 and 13 at the time of the trial. That's the State versus Hernandez non-precedential opinion that I cited in my brief, and it's a relatively recent opinion from this court. And I think that suggests that in fact, the victim's age at the time of trial is relevant to the analysis. And there are simply no facts in the record here other than the bare fact of the age of 12 at the time of the incident, that appellant has pointed to suggest that the jury was likely to conclude that the victim couldn't have known these things unless what she said the appellant did to her was true. And in light of that's simply not enough, especially when we remember that this was a sexually mature 12-year-old. She had reached puberty. She was capable of and did in fact conceive a child. There are varying levels of maturity at the age of 12, physical and intellectual for that matter. And there's no evidence here that the victim was developmentally delayed or mentally incapacitated in any way, shape, or form. And so none of those circumstances that were present in, for example, Crosses are present here. And I think we have to remember that the standard of review here is not de novo. It's an abuse of discretion. And the question here is whether the district court abused its discretion when it concluded that, one, this evidence wasn't relevant, two, even if it was relevant, it still didn't survive the Rule 403 balancing test that was necessary, even if it were relevant. And I think the other thing to remember here is that appellant seems to argue that basically, when considering prejudice, you should consider that the case was tried exactly as it was and the evidence came in, except the jury heard evidence that Lopez Ramos had sexually abused the victim. And I assume that they maintain that the DNA evidence that demonstrated conclusively that Lopez Ramos was not the father of the victim's child wouldn't come in. But that's simply irrational. If the district court had allowed the defendant to introduce evidence that Lopez Ramos had sexually abused the child, the victim, it would have to allow the DNA evidence that excluded Lopez Ramos from being the father, that is, from being the individual who committed the act that constituted this crime, it would have to allow that evidence to come in. Otherwise, it would be depriving the state of a meaningful opportunity to respond to the defendant's evidence. I quite frankly, I think that the appellant's trial attorney, by not actually making an alternative perpetrator defense, was trying to take a strategy wherein he was able to get in a limited reference to the Lopez Ramos's involvement, and hopefully close the door on the state being able to offer the DNA evidence that excluded Lopez Ramos. I think the real purpose that that appellant sought to introduce this evidence was to confuse the jury about who might be the father. And in a world where the DNA evidence that said that the that Lopez Ramos was excluded from being the father couldn't come in, the district court took a very reasonable position consistent with the facts and the law, applied the correct standard. There's been no argument made that the district court applied an incorrect standard of law to the question, to the 412 question here. It applied those standards, made a reasonable decision that evidence of Lopez Ramos's sexual abuse of the victim was not admissible, and therefore none of that evidence came in. The DNA evidence doesn't come in. And the case is tried based on the strength of the evidence, based on the fact that the victim said that the appellant did what he did to her. The appellant admitted in his police interview that he had had sexual intercourse with the victim and had not used the condom. And the DNA evidence showed, to the exclusion of the rest of the world, that the appellant was the father of the victim's child. And it was on that evidence that the case was tried and should be tried. And the district court was eminently reasonable to say that the supposed other source evidence was not relevant and therefore was not admissible, because it would only, unless the full panoply of evidence, including the DNA evidence that excluded Lopez Ramos, came in, the only purpose for introducing the evidence, the so-called other source evidence, was to confuse the jury. That was the purpose of it, and to raise a fanciful or metaphysical doubt that was easily dispensed with by the scientific evidence, if it would have come in. In light of all the facts and circumstances here, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied this motion. The appellant never actually asserted an alternative perpetrator defense. The district court didn't analyze an alternative perpetrator defense because I think it's clear from the district court's order that the district court didn't understand the defendant to actually be making an alternative perpetrator defense at the relevant hearing. There's no record of any notice of an intent to assert that defense. And even if you look at the transcript of the March 17th, 2020 pretrial, the defense counsel makes no mention of an alternative perperpetrator there. In light of all of those things, the district court didn't abuse its discretion. And even if in some on some remote chance this court should conclude that it did, there certainly is no real likelihood or substantial likelihood that the denial of the motion affected the defendant's rights. The error was simply harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Had the evidence been admitted, like I earlier said, the evidence that the DNA testing excluded Lopez Ramos from being the father of the child would have come in, and the jury would have reached exactly the same conclusion it did here. For all of those reasons, I would ask this court to affirm the appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appears to be no other questions. And so, Ms. Workman, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to discuss those DNA results for Lopez Ramos, because I think that is an issue that we need to get into here. Respondent has made a lot of those results. And I'll tell you that there is nothing in this record before this court about those results. The prosecutor never argued that it was that those results would be brought in if the court allowed the 412 evidence to be introduced. It cannot be said then that it is a certainty that those results would have come in. But even if they had been introduced, we don't know what defense counsel could have done with those results to further kind of poke holes in this case, shall we say. And by that, I mean, he could have engaged an expert to discuss the three related individuals being involved here. He could have cross-examined even more rigorously on the efficacy of the results and the methodology used. He could have done even more cross-examination of the DNA testing methods, and if that is possible when there are three individuals who are involved in one case.
Ms. So Workman, yes. Isn't that precisely part of the problem, though, because the district court record we're reviewing, the district court was never presented with any of that evidence, and not even an offer of proof or an affidavit, anything that would perhaps connect the dots, at least when the court was doing the probative value evaluation, the 403. Wouldn't it be your client's obligation to bring forth something that would suggest that the DNA is significantly in question because of the relationship of all three of these parties, the victim and the two perpetrators?
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you. I will remind the court that the district court did take judicial notice of all of the filings in the record in Lopez Ramos's case. So that was before that court, and presumably the court would have known then what the DNA results were in that case. But I just want to make very clear for the record that when it came time to argue the 412 motion, the prosecutor never relied on the Lopez Ramos DNA results as a reason to not introduce the 412 evidence. And as far as any suggestion that it was a certainty that those would be introduced at trial, we can't say that based on this record.
Ms. Workman, I want to shift to a different issue, or a little bit of a different issue. As you know, our standard of review is very deferential. It's an abuse of discretion standard of review. And here there's a balancing that the district court undertook between the probative value and the potential for unfair prejudice. I didn't hear you really address the unfair prejudice prong. I think the district court had very serious concerns about the potential for unfair prejudice. So, you know, even if we were to agree with you that the evidence had probative value, how did the district court abuse its discretion in the weighing?
Well,
what is your best argument in that regard?
For one reason, the district court tended to put all of this on the embarrassment and the shame that the victim might suffer because she would have to discuss another incident of abuse by another person. And while that is something that the court can consider, that embarrassment and shame does not outweigh my client's right to put forth his constitutional right to put forth a meaningful defense. And he was cut off at the knees, essentially, by not getting to put in this evidence. And
the judge here was quite explicit. In addition to being humiliating, the evidence unfairly prejudices and stigmatizes the victim and has the potential to confuse issues and mislead the jury. Those are some pretty strong comments.
That is, and that's what I mean when I'm saying that he put a lot of weight upon that. That's not the only consideration that the court should get into. He should also consider Mr. Ventura's right to put forward a meaningful defense, and he couldn't do so without this evidence in that case.
Well, it appears that there was a balance that was going on, and I guess your time is running out, but if you don't mind answering my question, you're arguing that the balance needed to be weighed in your client's favor, but we're a reviewing court. We don't rebalance that.
I'm not asking for you to rebalance. I'm asking you to take a look at the way that the balancing was done. And from what it seems from this record, it seems that the balancing was done only in favor of the state and the victim. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions here today and your briefing in the matter. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling in the statutory time period. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you. You too.